So, welcome to the second talk of this afternoon session. Our speaker is Wolfram Freitag, my colleague from the University of Konstanz, and he's giving a talk on first-person epistemology and skepticism.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for your interest. As you see on the handout and here, I've changed the title a bit, but not the content of what I'm going to say. Well, let's start it this way. When we think of Descartes, what did he leave to epistemology? I think he left basically two things. One thing is a problem, namely the problem of skepticism. The question of whether we can actually know when we do know, or whether we can know, can have knowledge about, for example, the external world. And then he left us a kind of methodology, namely first-person epistemology, basically the approach to the questions of access to the external world or questions of knowledge in the from the first-person perspective, which Descartes obviously pursued in his meditations. Now, nowadays, we are not so much engaged in first-person epistemology, at least usually not, but in third-person epistemology. But you will find that crucial junctures of the debate, especially when it comes to such things like intuitions for skepticism or internalism, you find first-person approaches to the matter, first-person descriptions of epistemic situations. What I want to suggest here in this talk is that there is a link between these two types of Cartesian legacies, namely between skepticism and first-person epistemology, consisting in the fact that first-person epistemology supports skepticism, and it does so in what I think an illegitimate way. Okay, so there is something going wrong, or I suggest that there can be something going wrong in first-person epistemology, something which goes wrong in the direction of skepticism. So first-person epistemology might be part of a problem, namely the problem of skepticism, and I want to explain today why I think so. I suggest the reason that first-person epistemology is misleading us is that it's misleading our intuitions. And it does so by creating a possibility for confusing assertion conditions with truth conditions. And this leads to the view that truth conditions of epistemic propositions involve higher order epistemic states. And this view, other people have called it a level confusion. This type of level confusion then is directly supportive towards skepticism. What I want to do here is first discuss assertion conditions and claim that assertion conditions are themselves epistemic in nature. Then I will transfer the insights concerning assertion conditions towards first-person knowledge descriptions. Then I will switch to the skeptical argument and just outline it and show that the skeptical argument rests on a certain plausibility of a certain thesis, which usually is thought to be resting on the notion of closure, of epistemic closure, which I will argue, in fact, it is not. Okay. And in fact, I will say that it's a level confusion due to the first-person stance, which might explain the plausibility of the crucial premise here. Okay, let me start. When you talk about assertions and correctness of assertions, this can mean at least two things. First, you can talk about the truth or falsity of an assertion. So an assertion may be true or false. Okay, obviously, so at least with minor complications, complications which we need not address in here. For example, Tom's assertion of Tim is playing football is correct in this aletheic sense, in this true sense, if and only if Tim is playing football. Okay. And similarly, if Tom says that Tim knows that he has two hands, so he makes an epistemic assertion, then this is correct if and only if Tim is in the right epistemic position, whatever that may be, with respect to the proposition, I have two hands. But there are also correctness conditions which are called assertion conditions. So correctness conditions beyond truth. Okay. Most people would say that these assertion conditions are of an epistemic nature. So you must not assert a proposition P if you are not in the right epistemic position concerning this proposition. So assert that P only if you epsilon that P, where epsilon stands for the right epistemic relation. Now it's very contentious what the right epistemic relation is. Okay, some people say it's beliefs, other people say it's justified belief, and some people say that it's knowledge. For example, Timothy Williamson and other people. So they would applaud the thesis that you can assert only what you know. Okay. Now, I want to be not committal with respect to the precise nature of the epistemic stance that you need for assertability. But for sake of simplicity and definiteness, I will here just go with the Williamson view and say that the knowledge rule is correct. Okay. I think not much of my argument hinges on that, but I will do it just for simplicity here. So the rule is assert that P only if you know that P. Okay, so the truth conditions for A's assertion of S knows that P are fulfilled if and only if S is, with regard to P, in an epistemic position strong enough for knowledge. And the assertion conditions for A's assertion of S knows that P are fulfilled if and only if A knows that S knows that P. That is, if and only if A is, with regard to proposition 3, in an epistemic position strong enough for knowledge. So let me make some observation about this. First, truth conditions and assertion conditions of epistemic assertions are epistemic in nature. Secondly, the truth conditions concern the epistemic position of the occupant of the subject role, the person S. And the assertion conditions concern the epistemic position of the occupant of the asserter role, in the A. Third, the epistemic state of the asserter is about the epistemic state of the subject. So, if the truth conditions concern a subject's epistemic state of order n, so S knows that P, then the assertion conditions concern the asserter's epistemic state of order n plus 1. Namely, A knows that S knows that P. Okay, so it's, you have a hierarchy here. So, the assertion conditions of epistemic assertions comprise higher order epistemic states. Okay. This is the result of our investigation of assertion conditions and truth conditions. Now, how does it transfer to first person knowledge description? Take now A saying, I know that P. Okay. Then the truth conditions are fulfilled if and only if A knows that P. And the assertion conditions are fulfilled if and only if A knows that A knows that P. Okay. So truth conditions and assertion conditions are, of course, both epistemic in nature. And in this case, because the person speaks about herself, they concern one and the same subject, namely A. The truth conditions concern A's epistemic state of order n, and the assertion conditions concern A's epistemic states of order n plus 1. But because these epistemic states relate to one and the same subject, we might easily confuse the two different senses of the question, is A's assertion correct? We might think, well, that's just one sense. In other words, we might subsume the assertion conditions under the truth conditions. And if we did that, then we would have something like a level confusion, namely something assuming that the higher order epistemic state, the n plus 1 epistemic state, belongs to truth conditions of the lower order epistemic states. Now this would result in what William Olson has called a level confusion in epistemology. And he has made the point mainly with respect to internalism. Okay, he did it in the 80s. But Olson then did not give any rationale behind such a systematic level confusion. And I think the possible mixing up between assertion conditions and truth conditions due to the first person epistemic descriptions, to this first person epistemology might explain why such level confusions in epistemology, if they are there at all, of course, are there. Okay, so this could be an explanation of these level confusions in epistemology. Now, right now, I've been just talking about the possibility of such a confusion suggested by the nature of assertion conditions and truth conditions here in such first-person cases. Now, but let's look how this works with a specific example, namely the skeptical argument, which has been, I think, next to the Getty problem, the driving motive within epistemology in the past 30 or 40 years. So I just give you the normal outline of the argument. Let the proposition hands be the proposition I have hands, and EIV the proposition I am a brain in a bat. Okay, you all know this, I suppose. So a skeptical argument then would run as follows. I do not know that non-EIV, because I do not know that I am not a brain in a bat. And if I know that I have two hands, then I know that I am not a brain in a bat. So this would be the second premise in the classical exposition of the argument. It follows by the modus tollens that I do not know that hands, that I do not know that I have hands. Now, the argument can be generalized for all types of ordinary propositions. So people think if this argument goes through, then we have some kind of full-blown skepticism with respect to normal, empirical, ordinary propositions. Now, many people think that this argument, at least at the outset, is very, very suggestive and very successful. So they devise the right type of answer to it. And one answer would be, actually, the historically lightest answer would be neo-Murianism, which just denies the first premise of the skeptical argument and says, well, after all, you can know that you don't, that you are not a brain in a bat. Mm-hmm. Now, many people are unsatisfied with this response, so there are complications for that. For example, epistemic contextualism, which actually makes quite the same move as neo-Murianism, but in a more dialectically complex way. Namely, it says that the meaning of no is context-sensitive, so P1, whether P1 is true or not, depends on the context in which you utter it, and in ordinary context, P1 is actually false, but it is true in high standard context. And why do we accept the skeptical argument, and with that P1 usually? Well, because once we utter the skeptical argument, we are already in high standard context. Okay. But in non-skeptical context, P1 can be false. So according to non-skeptical context, you do know that you are not a brain in a bat. There's a third standard reaction to it, to this argument, which does not apply to the first premise, but to the second. And this third response to it says that P2 is false, and they do so by denying closure. Okay. So almost anyone in the field says that P2, the second premise, actually is a consequence of epistemic closure. I'm going to explain in a second what that means. Okay. And so some say, well, if you give up P2, then you have to give up epistemic closure. And this is the answer of, for example, Fertelsky and Robert Nozick. Now, I think there's a fourth reaction, and a much better reaction than all three of them. I mean, these three positions might be true. Okay, it's nothing I want to argue about. But they are all very problematic. And I think there's a fourth position, namely just deny the second premise without denying closure. Okay. Now, in order to have this possibility, I must first show that the second premise is not a consequence of the closure. Okay, the second premise is, if I know that I have hands, then I know that I'm not a brain in a bat. And closure means just something of the sort of, if the subject knows that Q and P follows from Q, then the subject also knows that P. Now, this is a very strong closure principle, and nobody ever would evoke that. Well, not nobody, David Lewis did, but and he's not a nobody, but most people would say it's much too strong. I'm going to show that P2 doesn't follow from this strong principle. If it doesn't follow from this strong principle, then also not from any weaker principle. So if it's independent of closure, it's also independent of any weaker closure principle. Okay. Observe that P2 is a consequence of closure if and only if hands entails non-VID. That is, if and only if my having two hands is incompatible with my being a brain in a vat. Now, this is not correct. There is no such incompatibility. The proposition, I'm a brain in a vat, just means that my brain is not properly hooked up with reality. My mental states are not fed by reality, for example, by perception, but perhaps by an evil scientist or by a Cartesian demon or whatsoever. It does not mean that my brains or my mental states are false, that this reality does not exist, that I don't have hands, that I don't sit in front of a computer, etc. So I have two hands is not incompatible with I am a brain in a vat. So P2 is not a consequence of closure. And hence, I may deny P2 without denying closure. Now at this point you will say, well yes, this is just how you chose the second premise. But let's just reformulate the second premise in such a way that it is a consequence of closure. Okay. Just redefine the skeptical proposition. And this what has been done is what has been done in the literature. So let's say, well, don't take BIB, but take BIB star, which says, I am a handless brain in a vat. Yeah. And call this a strengthened skeptical scenario. Now, with this proposition, BIB star, plugged into P2, it results in the following proposition. If I know that hands, then I know that non-BIB star. Okay. And this is indeed a consequence of closure, and therefore not deniable without denying closure. However, once you have changed the skeptical proposition, in quotation marks, in the second premise, you get a valid argument for skepticism only if you also change the first premise, where BIB still occurs. So what happens now? What with the first premise is now the proposition, I do not know that non-BIB star, which means I do not know that I'm not a handless brain in a vat. Now, many seem to accept this proposition P1 star on the assumption that if P1 star is false, one has to know that one is not in a skeptical scenario. That is, on the assumption that if P1 star is false, one would have to know that one is not a brain in a vat. But this assumption is simply mistaken. P1 star is truth functionally equivalent to the proposition I am not handless or I am not a brain in a vat. And to know such a proposition is not more difficult than to know that Humbert is not a handless murderer. An example from Nabokov's Lolita. Okay. Because to know that Humbert is not a handless murderer, it suffices to know that he's not handless. You don't have also to know that he is not a murderer. And similarly, in order to know that BIB star is false, it suffices that you know that you have hands. You don't have to know that you're not a brain in a vat. Okay. Now, the skeptic, of course, wants to argue that you don't know that you have two hands. But, of course, he cannot put that as a justification for his first premise, because he wants to have it as a result of his argument. So he must not presuppose that you don't know that you have two hands. Okay. So without antecedent skepticism, the argument seems just to fall apart. And we might generalize. As soon as you take the second premise to be of such a sort that it is entailed by closure, the first premise becomes wildly implausible. So I say that the question of closure is irrelevant to a skeptical argument, to a valid skeptical argument, with only a remotely plausible first premise. So return to the original form of the skeptical argument. Okay. The question is, why does the argument appear so plausible? Why do people accept the second premise? And I think one reason is that people constantly confuse the skeptical proposition, BIB, with the strengthened skeptical proposition, BIB star. You can see that actually in the literature, like Peter Unger, who has actually introduced the argument in its present form, he switches from the one, from the skeptical scenario to the strengths skeptical scenario, to and fro, whatever he needs. So because you switch between the two, you seem to have a plausible first premise while making the second premise closure-based. Now this is a minor reason. I think the major reason is that people think that P2 is plausible in the first step. So irrespective of closure. And the whole closure scenario is actually something to rationalize the apparent plausibility of P2. Now I want to say that P2 is not really plausible or should not be plausible in the first place. Okay. And observe, of course, that P2 is raised in first person. Okay. It's certainly plausible to assume that in order to know that hands, or in order to know that you have hands, you must not be a brain in a head. Okay? This is certainly plausible. You must not be a brain in a head. But this alone does not support P2. However, if because of the first person presentation, you confuse assertion conditions with truth conditions, then you assume that in order to know that you have two hands, you must know that you have hands, and therefore, by closure, that one must that you must know that BIV that you must know that BIV is false. Okay. Once you have this first person induced level confusion, the second premise just becomes plausible, but otherwise it doesn't get plausible. So P2 is supported by the level by a level confusion in epistemology, and I suggest that this is actually due to the first-person presentation of the argument. Okay. Now I'm almost at the end here. I want to say that the persuasiveness of the skeptical argument stems from an unholy alliance of two subtle confusions. First is that of assertion conditions with truth conditions, and this is due to the first-person presentation of these types of arguments. Okay. And then you rationalize the appeal of the second premise by proposing a closure-based version of the argument, which either doesn't work because it is not closure-based, or you get a very implausible first premise. Okay. So this rationalization is usually just mistaken and founded in the confusion of skeptical and strengthened skeptical scenario here. So if that's correct, then you can reject the skeptical argument without appealing to any of the contentious positions like neo-Murianism, contextualism, or non-closure theories. Okay. What you need is just a careful analysis and an avoidance of the confusion associated with first-person epistemology. Now, I think with regard to the specific skeptical argument, the first-person considerations already show their strengths. But I think the first-person considerations have a much more influence in philosophy than just on this argument. And I think a lot of internalism rests on it, at least from a motivational perspective, and also a lot of other types of skeptical forms. But of course, I'm not arguing for that here. Thanks.